You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on April 21st, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate, Greg, and I examine the Bundy Ranch crisis in Nevada and discuss what Alan West's latest comments tell us about American ideologies. Then, Daniel Fidler joins me to review HBO's Veep. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio. You can also like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Maryland after a few weeks off is Greg. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me in studio now is Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
We're going to start off the state of Nevada, the Bundy Ranch crisis that's developing there. Basically, a rancher out there who says that he refuses to accept the existence of the federal government has been grazing his cattle on public lands owned and managed by the federal government in the state of Nevada. Many of the lands in Nevada and Utah and the other Mountain West states are under federal management. He says that he does not have to pay grazing fees, which is the typical way that the federal government makes money off of the grazing fields and lands there, which is important because they obviously need to have revenue to be able to pay for their operations and management and oversight and things like that. So this money, they have to pay staff at the Interior Department. So he has been refusing to pay those since 1993. There have been repeated federal court settlements saying that he has to pay, that he has to pay all these giant amounts of money that he's been owing for this whole time.
Apparently it's around $1 million just over the 20 years.
A pretty significant amount of money. And he obviously hasn't paid it because he doesn't accept the existence of the federal government. The result now is that the Bureau of Land Management came in and started seizing his cattle or driving them off of the land or both. And this prompted all of the anti-government so-called militia types, the patriot groups, to show up from all over the Mountain West region with their automatic weapons in tow and assault rifles and everything and their handguns. And then the Bureau of Land Management backed off a little bit because they're not there to get shot. That's sort of where we find ourselves now. Nate, what were some key points you wanted to highlight in this story?
Well, I mean, you were talking a little bit about the rancher Cliven Bundy does not particularly recognize the federal government. And I'm just reading a LA Times article here, just tracing his history a little bit. I've also been on this guy's blog. His ancestors were Mormon settlers out in the area, and it seems like he's sort of taken that ideology, that good old-fashioned frontier Mormon ideology, and, you know, just extended it, applied it to the modern world. And he's got some of his friends to come out to the ranch just to help him out, just get the feds away. But one of the key points in this whole debate is actually the welfare of a Mojave Desert tortoise, a particular species of tortoise that's been relatively endangered recently. It's the fact that it was endangered was actually one of the main reasons why the Bureau of Land Management modified its grazing rights in 1993, just because they wanted to protect the tortoise. And there's not too many of these tortoises, only a couple thousand, I think, in the area. So they're just trying to make sure that they have enough land. And they, obviously, they overlap a bit with these cattle. So they're trying to make sure that the tortoise was protected. But basically, over these past 20 years, a lot of people on the right have tried to use it sort of like the spotted owl as like a economic scapegoat, and basically saying the federal government only cares about the tortoise and not actually the welfare of the people that live there. This is a classic tactic. And, you know, we're seeing that the tortoise is sort of being used as an excuse. They're only trying to protect this tortoise and they're trying to force us off the land, when really he's just not paying his taxes. I mean, that's sort of what it comes down to. And, you know, we could end up with the worst of both worlds, in which the tortoise is driven off some of its habitat, and, you know, he's just openly flaunting the authority of the federal government, which is not the best idea or the best outcome.
Right. And I think it's worth remembering here that the government is not an abstract concept. The government is the people, and it's the sort of collective representation of the people. And in this sense, the reason that they regulate these vast federal lands rather than just having it be a free-for-all is because it does use up resources and, you know, potentially it might be unsustainable depending on how much grazing is going on there or how many people are grazing and how many cattle they have. So the idea here is that the government is conserving these resources, Teddy Roosevelt style, the idea being that we won't be able to hunt all the buffalo in the future if we don't save the buffalo now, or in this case, we won't be able to graze our cattle on these lands if we don't keep a certain amount of regulation on the usage of these lands. Obviously, that's the quintessential Tragedy of the Commons example in the first place, which is that people were going and grazing on these common areas in early colonial America or the contemporary England at the time, and they would have too many cows, not enough grass, the grass would get used up, and then nobody could use it. So the idea here is that the government isn't doing this arbitrarily. The government isn't doing this just to make money off of people. The government is here acting on behalf of the people and is managing the land on behalf of the people because it does belong to all of us. But if everyone just used it willy-nilly, we wouldn't have it anymore.
Just to take a little detail of that and add a little legal detail from this case, Bundy actually argued in 1993 in court, in actual, you know, United States legal court, that his Mormon ancestors had worked the land long before the BLM was founded, so therefore his rights predate that of the federal government. But if you're actually going by the original ideology of many of the Mormons that moved out there, I mean, that's correct. They tried to form their own country, the state of Deseret, in Utah and parts of Nevada and other parts of mountain states. And there were a lot of, you know, Mormon people that lived outside of that, you know, technical area that still abided by a lot of those sort of frontier laws. And I mean, that's a legitimate point of view in about 1870, you know.
Right.
That was a while ago, but I mean, that was a real debate. Although, back then.
Yeah, at the time it was territory of the United States rather than an organized state of the United
and
States.
Plus there were
not in the 1870s, obviously. This would have been before the U.S. Civil War, but yeah.
Right, but and there were also, you know, various wars going back and forth as various state officials tried to hunt down the Mormons. The Mormons responded, massacres back and forth, and all that. But, you know, it really is interesting to sort of see how this this relic of this ancient era where you had basically a frontier settler setting up their own country with their own laws and really seeing how that is even now today still there's still a balance that people are trying to strike in order to respect both individual rights and sort of the communal rights. But it's just interesting to see in this case that sort of the conflicts over Mormonism and some of the and just the conflicts over land in the West still exist to this day. I mean,
absolutely.
I think it's so long ago, but really, in the course of the country,
this is actually, I would argue that besides the precedent with the Mormon colony of Deseret, basically, he's got this position that's not only like an 1840s, 1850s view of this, but he's actually got this like 1780s view, Articles of Confederation style, where you say that these are the United States of America, as in nation states that have formed a union, much like, say, the Union of the Netherlands or whatever, right? The United Republics of the Netherlands. And in that, of course, eventually becomes one solid country like the United States. But as many of these things start out, they say, oh, we're just forming like a partnership, an alliance between these. You know, we'll have a common foreign policy, but we're actually sovereign states. In fact, the U.S. Senate, when they made the Constitution to replace the Articles of Confederation, the U.S. Senate was designed almost to be a collection of ambassadors from the sovereign states, right? They were appointed by the state governments as envoys to Washington, which would be why you would have an equal number of them from each state. And that's not really how we view the United States today. And it really diverged pretty much even before they had actually ratified the Constitution. But he's got this really old school view. He literally says, what they have done is seized Nevada statehood, Nevada law, Clark County public land, access to land, and have seized access to all the other rights of Clark County people that like to go hunting and fishing. They've closed all those things down and we're here to protest that action. Right, so he's pitching this as liberty, but he's also consistently saying that Nevada is a sovereign state and that he's justified in not recognizing the federal government because Nevada is its own country, much in the way that the Indian reservations are domestically considered to be their own country or were for a while and are now, you know, special sort of exceptional territories within the United States. But obviously Nevada does not have that status And of course, as The Atlantic pointed out, Matt Ford pointed this out on April 14th, because Nevada was brought in during the Civil War and had very pro-union sentiments, its state constitution literally says, in the Constitution, the paramount allegiance of every citizen is due to the federal government, and it also says that the Constitution of the United States confers full power on the federal government to maintain and perpetuate its existence, and whensoever any portion of the states or people thereof attempt to secede from the federal union or forcibly resist the execution of its laws, the federal government may, by warrant of the Constitution, employ armed force in compelling obedience to its authority. Right? So he's saying this is a sovereign, independent country, but in fact, Nevada has ceded its sovereignty right in its own state constitution and says that you have to comply with the federal laws. Nate, you wanted to respond quickly, and then we'll get to Greg.
Yeah, just not to keep hammering the Mormon point, but there have been, in the past several decades, a large amount of, or maybe not large, but a couple thousand fundamentalist Mormons, Mormons that still practice polygamy and all sort of the traditional ways that the regular Mormon church basically stopped doing in order to become a state, allowed Utah to become a state. This is, once again, an example of the fact that these issues still exist within America. It's not, you know, oh, this is just history and, you know, there's no conflicts over, you know, mini states, sub states, things like that. You know, you often hear about various ethnic groups or various breakaway states and like the caucuses or stuff like that. And you don't think that that could happen in America. But the thing is, there actually are these fiercely independent little pockets, especially in the West. And that's what we're dealing with right now. We got a bunch of people with guns and sniper rifles, and they're very willing to protect their land, and apparently at the expense of the desert tortoise. So,
right, and they're willing to take up that approach that essentially it's possible for there to be sort of a feudal alignment where you say we're actually our own country, but we're willing, like Monaco giving its foreign policy to France but remaining independent domestically, right, that we're willing to keep up that system. And that's not how the U.S. government views the situation, but that's how they view the situation. Greg, you wanted to hit the conspiracy theories angle.
I did, yes. So as Nate said, there are a lot of people out there that think maybe that this is not actually about what the federal government says it's about, as in protecting the desert tortoise. So there's a conspiracy theory that's going around the internet that basically goes along the lines. The U.S. Senator from Nevada, Harry Reid, who happens to be the current U.S. majority leader in the Senate, and a Chinese company are colluding with one another in order to get this land that the Bundys are grazing their cattle on and reclassify it for renewable energies like a solar power plant or something like that.
Greg, I couldn't hear everything that you said, but were you talking about conservatives believe that there is a land grab move by Harry Reid and a Chinese company to set up, is it like wind farms or
solar panels?
It's like solar panels.
Interesting. Yeah.
This has been widely circulated on the internet, but also debunked on the internet and debunked by very, very steadfastly right-wing websites like Breitbart.com, who explained that yes, in fact, there is a deal going on with Rory Reid, who happens to be Harry Reid's son, and he's trying to reclassify some federal lands for renewable energy developments. However, these lands that Rory Reid and the reclassification, that situation is happening 20 miles away from the land that's being disputed in the Bundy Ranch. Now, granted, I think a lot of conspiracy theorists would say that that doesn't prove anything, that the point that the Reeds and a Chinese company are colluding to take this land away from this patriot farmer rancher and give it to this foreign Chinese company in order to make scary, scary renewables. I still think that there are probably people out there that believe it, but I would like to note that even Breitbart.com has thoroughly debunked that theory.
I'm always fascinated by these right-wing conspiracy theories in which, like, Al Gore is, like, drumming up global warming or, like, faking it, basically, so his investments in alternative energy companies can pan out.
It's the longest con.
It's great. You know, it's like, let's convince everyone that oil's bad, even though it's, you know, extremely lucrative in comparison, in order to drive up prices for these alternative energies. And it's like, do these people realize, and they do because they harp on, you know, Solyndra all the time, do they realize how unprofitable some of these companies are and like how difficult it would be to make a ton of money off of like some like massive conspiracy involving these companies?
Yeah, and also
it's just one of them, it makes no sense.
And while they're on that, why don't they go look, what, one state over, two states over, yeah, I guess it'd be two states over in Wyoming, all the Republicans who lined up in Wyoming to support this coal liquefaction thing that's literally basically a fictional slash Nazi technology that was only ever effective in regimes that were on the point of collapse and were under a state of siege. And they've been trying to get federal loan guarantees for this disastrous project for 10 years that's going to be like several orders of magnitude more of a disaster than Solyndra if it gets approved. And the Department of Energy keeps like ignoring them. And they've been writing all these letters saying they need to get help. But, you know, it's only a conspiracy theory if you can somehow link Harry and Rory Reid to it or Al Gore to it or whatever. Because, you know, something, something Al Gore fat, something, something solar panels.
I do applaud their sort of hustle with this, though. I mean, I think they're probably the greatest hustlers of all time because they take these little bits and pieces of information and then draw these connections where there are ostensibly no actual connections. But it takes a lot of research to do all this stuff, and it takes a lot of screaming and yelling to convince people of your point. Maybe it doesn't take that much in this situation, because I think that people are doing a lot of mental gymnastics right now. We were talking about earlier with the Nevada Constitution says that the Nevada citizens basically defer to the federal government in these types of situations. So I think there's a lot of mental gymnastics going on there with what Bundy is arguing. And so it doesn't surprise me that that people that have this sort of worldview that they don't believe in the power of the federal government and all this stuff would seize upon this conspiracy theory, which is beautiful in the sense that it pits so many that are scary to, you know, right wingers. So
it's like a conspiracy theory fractal. They've joined all of the different elements together in a beautiful picture that every time you go into one of the little branches, it gets smaller and repeats.
Well, it's like the Glenn Beck chalkboard, you know, you've got right, all the different lines connecting each other.
Yeah. And I think that Harry Reid's not making it easier by openly calling them domestic terrorists. Yeah, although I think that
may
the,
have been a ill-advised statement.
It was ill-advised for him to say, but I think that if you show up with, you know, assault rifles to protect federal land from the federal government, that you're probably a domestic terrorist.
Right. And it's clear that the BLM was not expecting that. I mean, they came in and they thought, okay, we're going to go in here. We're going to, you know, drive the cattle off the land, or we're going to like confiscate the cattle, and it's not going to be an issue. They're not going to do anything. And then all of these people with guns showed up and they just said, you know, like we said earlier, we're not trying to get shot. And I think what's going to happen is I think a lot of people have been saying like, this is going to be the next Waco or something. And it's not, because there's no rush for the federal government. I mean, like, this has been going on since 1993.
The BLM, not the
ATF. Yeah, the BLM will hold out for 20 more years if they have to, but
right.
to avoid getting shot.
I mean, all they really need to do is just wait and, you know, keep going into the courts with this stuff, because eventually, you know, they have more money than the Bundys do. And so they're just basically going to, you know, bleed them until they can no longer afford to fight the government anymore. And then probably the government will actually own the entire ranch. So, I mean, it's not definitely pragmatic on the Bundys' part. They're making an ideological statement by saying, OK, we're not going to recognize the federal government's ability to come in here and tell us that we need to pay some fee in order to graze our cattle. But I think this is not that's fine short term. But long term, I think, you know, that Clive and Bundy is going to be the guy that's remembered in his family for losing the land to the federal government his bullheadedness.
Yeah, Uncle Sam always wins. Okay, but Nate, you disagree with my characterization that these people are domestic terrorists if they show up heavily armed to resist the federal government.
Well, I think they start becoming domestic terrorists once they start shooting people. But, you know, it is kind of semantics. They're doing threatening things, and in some ways that is terrorism. But I don't want to, you know, brand, you know, these border guards type, you know, militia groups as all necessarily terrorists. Some of them may be, but what I would say is I feel like the word terrorist is just thrown around way too much,
okay,
especially by the right, but in this case I think we should be a little wary of it too. It wasn't the best move politically, and I think just semantically for Reid to call them terrorists. But
okay, but here's
they're definitely threatening the federal government with guns.
Here's my question,
that's
though,
pretty unacceptable,
right? So you're saying that it's kind of splitting hairs and semantics or whatever, that you're acknowledging that in the sense that they haven't started shooting yet, and once they did. But like, what I'm saying is, if you threaten the federal government agents or whatever, even if they're not the ATF, they're the BLM, you threaten the federal government's people and prevent them from doing their jobs because they don't want to get shot. You know, it's a bloodless coup, but it's still a coup. I mean, like, in what sense do you have to actually be shooting or blowing stuff up to be, you know, now crossed into domestic terrorism territory?
I mean, they're certainly interfering with the workings of the federal government, and yes, they're armed. I just show up with a gun, wave it around, and make some threats like, okay, you're a crazy person. I don't necessarily think you're a terrorist. If you start shooting that gun at the officials, then, okay, you cross the line to terrorist. It just, I don't really think it makes a difference what we call them or not. You know, the whole thing about these people that guard the border or, you know prevent the illegals from getting across, they sort of act like it's a game. Like, the entire thing is just like a big game. Like, oh, we got to protect against the government and we got to catch all the illegals. And, you know, they're like stashing it. They sort of, it seems like they want to be soldiers, so they're trying to recreate Call of Duty in the desert in order to, like, fulfill that fix that they need, you know, hide in the foxhole and, oh, the government's coming and we need to protect ourselves against the troops. Is there really any danger that there's going to be an armed confrontation? It's not like the BLM has guns, so basically they're just sitting in the desert waving their guns around and yelling about tortoises and how his Mormon ancestors gave him the rights to this land. I mean, they sound like a bunch of whack jobs. It's not, you know, I'm not necessarily going to call them terrorists until they start, you know, actually shooting at or, you know, near, just in general. So,
okay, well, I agree with your point that the term is thrown around too much in general, but I think that as long as it's being applied to so many different people, maybe consider broadening the definition. A lot of people have been arguing, for example, that the situation in Kansas recently, the KKK guy who, in attempting to commit an anti-Jewish hate crime, managed to kill two Methodists and a Catholic, but he was trying to kill Jewish people because he hates Jewish people. So he shot people in Kansas in attempting to commit a hate crime, right? He's a domestic terrorist.
Yeah,
right. He shot people.
Okay, so you think that they have to start pulling the trigger for...
I mean, this guy murdered several people. What, three?
Yeah.
Four? Yeah. You're a murderer. You're a domestic terrorist, I guess, in that case, if you're, like, trying to single out specific ethnic or religious groups.
Yeah, I just
don't think that we should focus on, you know, whether, oh, are these guys terrorists? Are they just, like, misguided militia? Or, you know, what should we call them? I think it's very clear that the federal government needs to find a way to compel this man to pay his fees. And if he can't, then, you know, he shouldn't be allowed to graze on the line. Or work something out. Like, I don't think there need to be, okay, $1 million or nothing. They could just try to figure out a way. And it doesn't seem like, you know, he's going to negotiate in good faith. But they could at least try.
Greg, what do you think?
I don't know if there's any way. I really don't. Because, I mean, like, he's ginned up so much support. He's gotten so many people to come out there with guns and support him and to capitulate. And that's what I think that they would think that he was doing if he paid a single cent that he owes. To capitulate would probably be not the greatest thing in order to appease this militia that has come to his defense, but that I think could... I don't know. I mean, I don't know how, like, tightly, you know, screwed in those people are, really. So we'll see.
Uncle Sam, as we've all kind of coalesced around this consensus, is that they can persist longer than this family can, and somebody eventually will back down.
Well, I mean, I feel like if this was the 90s, we might have already gone in. If this was pre-Waco, pre...
Yes, in many ways, President Obama is a much more restrained domestic president, even if he's had some questionable foreign policy stuff.
He's restrained in about pretty much everything compared to Bill Clinton, but right. That's a different topic.
All right, well, hashtag move your cows. We're closing out this segment. We've got to move on to
hashtag
the next
segment. Hashtag save the tortoise.
Hashtag save the tortoise. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. From WVUD... You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line in Maryland is Greg. Joining me in studio still is Nate. We're going to be talking about some controversial comments by Alan West, former congressman of Florida. We're going to be looking at both the comments themselves and sort of a broader ideological viewpoint that he is hinting at in those comments. Basically, he was alleging that the there's about to be, and it was aided in this allegation by the terrible, terrible hosts of Fox and Friends.
Steve Doocy.
Yeah, in saying that there's about to be a third major party in the United States right next to the Democrats and Republicans. What party? The Muslim Brotherhood. Who's founding it? All of the major interest groups that are perfectly normal who advocate on behalf of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans. Alan West's favorite enemy group, because Alan West hates all Muslims and particularly all Arabs, is the group that he is typically known as CARE. What is that? Council on... That
Council
called?
Of American Islamic Relations.
And he hates that group. He also hates these various other, you know, Arab American advocacy groups and things like that. So he said, they're forming some type of political party, a voting bloc, as they call it. And then Steve Doocy jumps in and says, in this country? And then he says, that's right, to institutionalize policies that favor them. And then he said that they wanted to destroy America from within using a civilizational jihad, and that's exactly what you see happening. So, Nate, why don't you tell us a little bit about this former Florida congressman? Get us started on that angle.
Well, you know, Alan West made a good deal of headlines over the past couple of years just because he was in Congress, and he was just saying the most ridiculous, nonsensical things, how the Democratic Party was sort of the party of continued slavery and domestic programs
for
black people, keeps black people on the plantation. Yeah, that's what it was. So, you know, this guy likes to say somewhat out there things. But just to inform our listeners, back in Iraq, where he was once a lieutenant colonel, Colonel West, as he was known then, was involved in an incident, interrogation incident with a Iraqi police officer, Yashia Kadouri Hammoudi. And basically, he thought this Iraqi police officer knew of a plot to ambush him and his men or his battalion. And so he decided to interrogate the officer. And before,
personally?
Well, with his soldiers. And he, before the, this is from a New York Times article, before the interrogation, he told his soldiers, quote, this could get ugly, but he imposed limits. Quote, this man will not be injured and he will not have to be repaired. There'll be no blood or breakage of bones. And then apparently the U.S. soldiers, commanded by West, along with West, decided to beat this guy with their guns, hitting him in the head and chest repeatedly. And then Colonel West decided that in order to, you know, crack the case, it's a time-sensitive case, so, you know, got to be a little Jack Bauer, you know, just get it out of him. So he decided to fire his pistol repeatedly right next to Mr. Hammoudi's head.
Which is against all the rules and laws of everything.
I think so. I guess another detail that I forgot to include is he threatened to kill the Iraqi police officer before he shot the pistol next to his head. So, you know. There have been multiple instances of threatened executions, things like that, amongst American service members in Iraq.
Which was the kind of stuff that was being pulled in the Vietnam War, and we thought we had left that behind.
Oh, we did
but
that
no.
all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it's war. You know, you can sort of do whatever you want.
except for definitely you can't. And that's why he was not in the military after that.
Well, apparently the U.S. government didn't think that it was okay. This was actually before Abu Ghraib. So, you know, stuff really hit the fan shortly thereafter. But apparently he disregarded army rules and just he ended up having to resign from the military instead of being court-martialed. I think it was a decision over whether he would just accept the discharge and a fine or he would be court-martialed. And he, I guess.
For, to recap, torture.
Yeah. So he decided to run for Congress instead of being court-martialed for torture, which is, I guess, a good decision.
And the good people of his district saw fit to send him to Washington.
Briefly.
Briefly. And then there was redistricting.
Fortunately, they realized their mistake.
Redistricting did a number on this. But yeah, so and then, of course, you know, became this Tea Party champion guy, continuing to say outlandish statements, as Nate said earlier, and many of them very anti-Muslim statements.
He does not like Muslims.
Obviously, this whole Muslim Brotherhood thing, completely made up, like out of thin air made up. It's not based on anything.
I think he also said Hezbollah was establishing a foothold in America.
Sure. Like Louis Gohmert's theory about the Hezbollah anchor babies that were coming through Mexico. I don't understand how some of these people get into Congress. Why is there not some kind of entrance examination? And then they're the ones who are going around telling people that, you know, some people aren't good enough to be voting and that we need to keep the riffraff out. Greg, you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
I did. I mean, I think that there's this whole idea, and we've talked about it on previous episodes, where there's always been an element of stewardship in American democracy, because obviously we elect representatives that we think are a little bit more knowledgeable of the issues than us, and then we ask them to vote on our behalf. But obviously we don't send them out there with absolutely no anchor and completely entrust their judgment. That's why there are referendums. That's why you try to vote for people that hold similar values to you. And I don't think that it's like Plato's Republic, where we think that there are all of these philosopher kings that are running the government, and then we're just sort of like the people that have to toil and just defer to our elected officials and because they obey. Now, I think that the problematic thing that we've seen in the Tea Party recently is that they're increasingly distrustful of the public's ability to understand its interests and care for itself. So they're increasingly talking about, I think Bill talked about this in the accompanying, the article that actually spawned this conversation, where they're talking about, you know, democracy, but republic in the sense that it's like, you know, there are people that are out there that are supposed to take care of you, and they know what's in your best interest. And so you just need to shut up and deal with it.
The Plato's Republic concept, right. As you said earlier. Yeah. No, I mean, you and I had talked in December at great length about this problem in Thailand, where the opposition in Thailand will literally say to a New York Times reporter, "We believe that it's time for democracy to be suspended and there should be a council of experts that runs the government, because clearly the people are too underinformed and miseducated to participate in the voting system." And it's the same Tea Party attitude, as you said, that contributes to this idea of these voter ID laws and stuff. You know, some people will deny, "Oh, we're not trying to keep anyone from voting." But actually, if you really look into it, someone will say, "Oh, this is going to deny certain populations the ability to vote because they're not going to have the right IDs or whatever." And then you'll see someone respond and say, "Yeah, but they should get their act together and figure out how to get what they need, their paperwork done or whatever, to be able to vote, or else they don't deserve to vote because voting is a privilege, not a right." And everyone, you know, which, okay, that's not true, but saying that you should have to face certain barriers. There should be hurdles to your ability to vote. And that, as you said, goes back to this idea, and which I also talked about a little bit, but you put it in the Plato terms, the Plato's Republic with the philosopher kings. I use the example of the Roman Republic, this patrician ideal where you're not supposed to be participating. The upper class and the educated upper middle class are supposed to be in government acting on your behalf. That's why we have an electoral college. That's why we had an indirect Senate. You pointed that out in our December segment, this push for bringing back the indirect election of senators to keep the riffraff from participating in those elections, because that's the point, according to the Tea Partiers, which is why Alan West says stuff like institutionalizing policies that favor them. He says that as a negative thing, that an interest group doing what every other interest group in the world does, advocating for policies that favor them, that this is somehow some vast conspiracy or subversion of democracy or whatever, when in fact that's the point of democracy. But the Tea Party attitude is that it's not a democracy. It was set up as a republic, and the rest of the world, as I said in the article, defines this as a representative democracy, and they say, no, it's not a democracy at all. It's a republic, and it's supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be these philosopher kings. But as I said, Alan West and Louis Gohmert have been
two philosopher kings right there.
Right.
Just a lot of groundbreaking discourses that they've published, just doing a lot of a lot of real deep thinking by
this. Yeah, they get to just say garbage and nonsense and no one stops, and they're allowed to vote. I mean, Michelle Bachmann, when she was the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, she thought that it was appropriate to respond to a cyber attack with a nuclear device. She said that, okay? She was in a position where she was supposed to be the philosopher king and said that. I mean, it's nonsense. And, you know, and just, you can just say, oh, they're the Muslims under, like, the leading groups representing Muslims and Arab Americans saying that they want to, quote, destroy America from within using civilizational jihad. And that's exactly what you see happening. What are you even talking about?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting to watch the Fox and Friends segment with Alan West and Steve Doocy and some blonde girl that I don't know the name of. There's probably infinity number of them. It was shocking how many words he said without actually saying anything.
Right.
Just the things he said didn't mean anything. He basically just rattled off a list of, like, American pro-Muslim organizations, like interest groups, things
like
that.
It's all dog whistles.
And then it's said, oh, yeah, by the way, the Muslim Brotherhood is attempting to form a political party. Gave no evidence of that whatsoever.
Right.
Called CARE an unindicted co-conspirator in a terrorism funding case. I don't think there's any evidence of that. Unindicted. Hey, there could be, you know.
Part of it is just this vacuous thing of, you know, he has good delivery. I'm sure that's why he got elected in the first place, right? Because he's a relatively good speaker, right? So Alan West can say, you know, to institutionalize policies that favor them. And it's like, yeah, you know, that just means that they're supporting policies that favor them. That's literally what that means, is putting into laws policies that are not actively bad for them. And it's not even favoritism, but he uses the word favor as if it's slanted in their favor. Now, Greg, you wanted to talk a little bit about dog whistle politics before we close out this segment. I heard you mentioning that earlier when Nate was starting to say something. Give us your take on that.
Sure. I mean, like, I feel like at this point, you don't even need to really make coherent sentences anymore. I mean, there are certain key terms that'll get your base riled up. And so, I mean, I think in Alan West's case, he talks about jihad, he talks about Muslim, he talks about takeover, he talks about Sharia law and all of this stuff. And you can honestly, you don't even need to speak like jihad in a coherent sentence. You can just put these sort of dog whistle words right one after the other, and people can just create the sentence in their head, and they hear what they want to hear, and they get riled up, and then they think like, oh, there's a, you know, an enormous problem going on here, when in reality it's like we've been saying, there are, of course, in a representative democracy, in, you know, groups, interest groups that are trying to lobby for interests. That's just the nature of democracy. You band together, and, you know, like, yeah, a united voice is stronger than just one voice, and all of these things that we hear, all these plaudits, these platitudes that we hear about democracy, and yet when we surround it with these sort of like these touchstone words that I feel like the Tea Party has really just kind of made into these almost boogeymen,
right?
That you talk about jihad, you talk about this, you know, exactly. Sharia law and Arab and when you just, you know, phrase it in terms of the other, then people don't even consider that this is exactly what they're doing as well. Right. They don't consider that.
Right. In the earlier segment, and I've done it on previous episodes, I made my, you know, joke along the formulation of something, something solar panels or something, something black helicopters or something, something, whatever. And then like, that's my like joke version of that, which is where I don't actually say the thing. I just say the buzzwords, you know, and you and I have, Greg, have often joked something, something chemtrails. Trails, right? That's one of our go-to jokes. And the idea is that there are these keywords and these touchstones, as you say, even aside from the dog whistling coded stuff, where you just say these code words and then it activates this whole chain reaction in the listener's head. And what I'm saying is he is literally just filling in the something something with other vacant words that don't mean anything but sound impressive when they're linked together, right? That's the Alan West modus operandi. That's the entire model of Fox News. So I'm being flippant when I do that, but I mean, I've grown up around enough people who subscribe to the arch conservative views that I know what the keywords are. So even when they're doing the dog whistle stuff, whether it's racial or otherwise, I can pick up on that really quickly. And I've been sent into events, and there was one time when out of a field of four, I correctly picked months in advance who was going to win the primary, who was not the expected candidate. And I picked that solely based on which person got the most keywords that I was able to recognize. Nate?
Yeah, just to expand a little bit on some of Alan West's actual allegations, which we've sort of characterized as nothingness. But I do want to note what he says specifically. He talks about there was a blueprint discovered by some sort of FBI raid by a group of Muslims Americans. But this is back in 1991, by the way. They wrote a document, a campaign strategy for the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. Then he later says they want to destroy America from within using a civilizational jihad. They're forming some type of political party, a voting bloc, as they call it. They want to try to destroy America, and that's exactly what you see happening. So I just want to, you know, ask people, do you see that happening? Because I don't. In fact, I don't really think radical Islam has too much of a purchase on this relatively hedonistic, sinful nation. It just, there's a lot of aspects of our culture that don't really jibe with the tenets of really fundamentalist Islam. There's certain TV shows, large binge drinking. None of those things would really, just the whole sexual liberation of the country. These things don't necessarily jibe with jihad. So just my question is, if you're on, if looking on the ballot, is there a Muslim Brotherhood candidate, or, you know, just a ballot referendum question banning alcohol and requiring all women to wear burqas? Because I don't see that happening. And the more you talk about how Hezbollah is sending in anchor babies, or, you know, jihad is happening right under our noses and we got to prevent the spread of Sharia law, it's just a joke, really. There's no evidence of it. And the more you say that, it's just delegitimizing yourself and really crying wolf. You know, I would hope that maybe law enforcement would look at that before, you know, the normal people found out about it. But I'm just not really finding a whole lot of evidence to support Alan West's claims.
Also, like you said, look on the ballot. You can see any number of candidates from various parties, and that doesn't mean anything.
Socialists, communists.
Right. The last time, if I remember correctly, the last time there was a huge number of candidates from not one of the major parties that was breaking through in winning elections, doing what no other parties have been able to do, was like right before the Civil War. Right. Like there's been some other points where you had some, like, you know, progressive or, you know, bull moose type
and
candidates.
Those aren't
but
really real parties. They tended to be factional splintering.
Exactly. They tended
the
to be factions within the existing parties, or they were running on the main party lines. And there's certainly we've got a couple independents now. But the last time there was a third party managed to break through the two party system was when the Republican Party was created in the 1850s. That was the last time that one of the two parties got displaced by a third party.
So
the Muslim Brotherhood Free Soilers of, you know, America are going to form a coalition with the, you know, whatever nonsense independent party
Rainbow Greens,
right? And they're going to somehow break down the two party system where all other parties have failed. That completely seems logical. No, this
they're
is just
team up with the libertarians too.
It's just complete scaremongering and total garbage. And they just, you know, they say it in an authoritative way, and there you go.
I love the last detail of this roster article. Wes, however, did not explain how he intended to stop Muslims from using their constitutional voting rights to wage quote-unquote jihad on the country. I mean, I don't know how to stop invisible jihadists. Seems kind of difficult.
It's whatever he says in response to that question is going to be grosser than whatever he has said previous to that question, so he should just not say it.
We've got another segment coming up in just a second, but I'm going to have to let you both go. Nate, thank you for joining me again in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
And Greg, thanks for calling in from Maryland again.
Thank you.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. From arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. We're going to try something a little new here, do a political pop culture segment on the show, taking something that's happening in pop culture, whether it's movies or TV or whatever, and we are going to talk about the political angles, if it's either an explicitly political thing or a partly political thing. Obviously, I don't think I'm going to talk about like the politics of Game of Thrones or whatever. It's got to be about U.S. politics or something like that. Joining me in studio for the first time is Dan Fidler. You can follow him, Daniel_Fidler, on Twitter.
That's right.
And Dan, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dan, what is the first thing we're going to be talking about?
This season of HBO's Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
So obviously you and I have been watching the seasons before. I feel like it's a pretty good show that you can jump in and out of. I don't think you have to have necessarily seen it. I mean, obviously it helps with the character
right.
development, but you don't have to have seen it from the very beginning,
right.
which is why I thought it would be fine to, you know, tell people to jump on this train as it's leaving the season 3 station. Tell us a little bit about the basics of the show. You mentioned Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but who else is in this? Who's behind it? What is the show about exactly? What is Veep?
Well, it's created by Armando Iannucci, who made the film In the Loop and the television series The Thick of It. He is famous for having a way with curse words and making the English language sound that much more delicious because of it. It stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus as the Vice President of the United States, and the rest of the cast is comprised of her staff, which includes Tony Hale from Arrested Development as, what would you say he plays?
He's the body man. Yeah. So he's the person who carries around Vice President Meyer's huge bag of everything.
And whispers in her ear when she needs to know something. There is Anna Chlumsky as...
I think her chief of staff or deputy chief of staff. One of those positions.
Matt Walsh.
He's the communication director for the vice president's office.
And Timothy C. Simons plays Jonah.
Yes. Jonah is the liaison between the White House and the vice president's office. And he's essentially the heel character, I guess, to use the wrestling term. The one that everyone, like, you know, loves to hate and enjoys booing. The characters on screen actively abusing him at all times.
He's the Toby of this series, to quote The Office.
Right. All right, so we've got a number of clips pulled out from season three, episodes 1 and 2, the season premiere and the second episode. If you don't want to hear spoilers, you can, this is the last segment in the show, you can turn it off, you know, until the top of the hour, or turn it off if you're listening online, you know, you won't miss anything. But, you know, we're not spoiling major plot points here. We're just, you know, I guess there's a little bit of stuff from seasons 1 and 2 that maybe are going to be spoiled here. But mostly this is just a few, you know, quality moments that I think illustrate some particular points of interest. The first thing that we're going to be talking about is Selina Meyer's book that she's released, her, you know, her pre-presidential, like paving the way for a presidential run book. Right. And also, as relates to that, her position on abortion, which is something that comes up in episode 2. You know, what is her position on abortion? Because one of the major themes is that no one in this series wants to take a position on anything ever in any way, shape, or form. And obviously, that's part of the satire of Washington. But, you know, before we get started, there was a recent BuzzFeed article, actually, on all these political memoirs and these sort of policy book things that get released by all these candidates. And obviously, you know, if it's like Mitt Romney's book or Barack Obama's books, both the one from way before he was going to run for president and when he was about to run for president, those sell really well because the person gets the nomination and then, you know, maybe gets elected president in Obama's case. Some of these other books basically get pretty limited print runs. They're quite expensive to make. They get bought by everyone in Washington, D.C. and no one else. And then no one actually has to read them because all the D.C. journalists just summarize the most interesting parts on, you know, online everywhere freely.
They're ghostwritten too, right?
Yeah, they're generally ghostwritten by a staff member in many cases. You know, some of these people make a substantial amount of money off them, especially 10 years ago or so. You know, John McCain was putting out a book like every, like, you know, 6 months practically, I think. And those did pretty well. But the BuzzFeed investigation was saying, especially on the Republican side, these seem to have topped out, particularly in light of some of the, you know, quote unquote scandals, like where Tim Pawlenty, Super PAC or something, tried to buy up like half of the entire print run to make sure that it would be high on the New York Times bestseller list. So it's all kind of this huge shell game and total garbage. So that's kind of, they decided to open the season by satirizing this book. And we're going to hear just how bad of a book this is you know, from the title to the content and how totally and utterly vacuous it is. So let's give a listen to that now.
So kind to say so.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for coming today. Nice to see you. Thank you so much. Come forward.
Yep.
Is this one a caucus goer?
Could be. Is that a Star Wars reference, A New Beginning?
No, this is actually Some New Beginnings, Our Next American Journey.
Too late to change it?
It is. Yeah. Hello.
Now, this one's caucus.
Oh, that's too loud.
Okay.
Can't say it that loud. I think you're going to dig it. Let's raise minimum wage. Blind people are people too. A very enjoyable read. It's complex. I'm exhausted. Journey is endless, you know. Global issue. I call it Some New Beginnings because it's plural. God bless you, etc.
So that was Vice President Selina Meyer signing her book in Iowa, trying to get, you know, she hasn't even announced she's running for president. She's just trying to build general support among Iowa caucus goers. How would you describe her interactions with the human masses of the American voters?
She doesn't have the social skills to to talk with actual people.
And also awkward with people who aren't in her
inner circle. Yeah,
right? She clearly very upset with this ringer guy they've sent to help her with this book tour. And then, you know, a lot of this is this mix, I think, in episodes going back and forth between her public interactions and her private interactions, again, with people that she either trusts or is reasonably comfortable being open with. So we're going to hear, I think he's the White House chief of staff, if I remember what his position is correctly. He wanders into the hotel room where she's hiding from the public, essentially, and she's got all these stacks of books, and they're both talking about how terrible the book is while he signs copies in her name,
right.
And she, you know, takes a break. So let's give a listen to that interaction.
Look at us. You pretending to be me, signing a book I didn't even write.
Well, that's politics in a nut.
Yeah.
New beginnings, our next American journey.
What do you think of that title?
Well, it's so full of shit, there's a colon right smack dab in the middle.
Oh, God. They kept coming up with all of these awful titles. You wouldn't even have believed it. Like, Footsteps to the Future was one. Red, White, and You was actually another one. Yes. Hands of Our Children.
What?
It was like a massacre or something.
It's sick.
I know. I was so busy listening to these stupid I didn't listen to this voice in my own head saying, this is dog Selena, this is complete dog. No, don't step in it. Don't. You just stepped in it. Now look here. It's printed in a book, so that's good.
So obviously, you know, she didn't write the book. As Dan mentioned, a lot of these books are ghostwritten. That's pretty typical, I think, in real life of these memoir things. But then everyone combs through them, usually with the index, so they don't actually have to read it. And they try to find the, you know, specific positions. So in the second episode, as we're going to hear from some clips from now, she is forced to take a public position on abortion, really doesn't want to. And the first place they try to look is in her book, and that just doesn't help in any way in identifying her position, right?
Right.
Mike, we're trying to figure out how I think about this issue.
Okay,
you know?
Well, the Post actually wants to know if you've changed your stance on abortion, RE, POTUS.
Yeah.
So you could say, as a woman, I believe
No. I can't identify myself as a woman. People can't know that.
Hey, ma'am, didn't you write something about abortion in your book?
Yes.
Oh, good point.
Yeah, good point.
Good, Gary.
Yeah. Good.
Where's the book? Does anybody have a copy of the book here?
What is
Guys,
it?
Guys, who has a copy?
What did she write?
Oh, you know
is
what?
Is one here?
I have a bunch of unsold ones in my car.
Honey, okay. Is Lena's book in the bathroom?
Okay, here we go. Abbey Road, Abolition, Aboriginal Mass.
Page 135.
Oh, this is it.
Yay. Freedom is what this nation is built on, blah, 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 blah. And freedom means the freedom to choose how to use that freedom to protect the
freedom
of others.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's just pastel colored. It's got to be more clear than that.
You make it very clear. You're pro-choice.
Okay, I got it. Freedom is what this
nation
is.
Yeah, done it, Mike. It's going to come down to the cutoff week. It always does.
There's two doors, okay? Pro-choice, pro-life.
Yeah.
There's no point in rattling the handles on either one of them. You just got to pick a door and walk through it. Two doors. Pro-choice, pro-life. That's it.
Is there a third door?
What, like a woman's door?
A back door? No.
A trap door.
Let me see this. And what is this spike right here?
The I don't knows.
Okay, so I am looking at a page, and I am seeing most of America standing up proudly and saying, I don't know.
We were shocked ourselves.
So obviously the book wasn't any help in elucidating her position in any way whatsoever. I would say probably this is going to go up there in that sort of trinity with Scandal, with House of Cards, right? In the sense of these modern political shows that are, you know, set in D.C. today, as opposed, you know, they're not West Wing or whatever, mm-hmm. Although many people still watch that regularly, but that's not on the air. But those are the three current D.C. shows, I think. Obviously, this is a lot funnier than House of Cards, probably. Substantially less murdering and such things. What do you think this says about kind of where the demand is in, you know, for the audiences in terms of pop culture, right? Is this something, these sort of less flattering portrayals, all three of those shows I would say have less flattering portrayals of DC than what we maybe used to see. Do you think that's what the audiences are looking for right now? What is behind this trend toward these shows that are less flattering toward DC?
I don't know, but I think DC likes it, because every time I've seen someone from Scandal, House of Cards, or Veep on a talk show, they've all mentioned that the White House and the Secret Service, they all love these three shows, and they watch them, and they gossip about them themselves.
The other thing that you wanted to talk about was this kind of gossiptainment concept, political gossiptainment. Obviously, in the first episode, as we're going to hear, Jonah's character, the much-hated Jonah, tries to start a blog called West Wing Man.
Westwingman.net? Never heard of this.
Come on, man, you're embarrassing yourself. That's the hottest gossip site in D.C.
Yeah? Lifting the lid on the interagency softball league? Face-to-face with America's wind tycoons. Wow, this is some seriously butter knife dull shit, man.
No. Underneath, that's grit legit.
So what's West Wing Man got on the Mannix thing?
No, nothing yet, but he will. If it ain't on West Wing Man, it ain't no thing, man.
It's you, isn't it?
Who told you that?
You just did, you dummy. God!
Keep that under your hat.
Yeah, sure.
That's just between you and me.
Uh-huh.
Dan, what did you think about this political gossiptainment aspect of it?
Well, as someone who's interested in the journalism world, it definitely shows that you got to be careful when you start a blog, because you could PO a lot of people if you are not doing it properly. Obviously, if you're working for the White House, you should not be writing a gossip blog about the White House. But this plot was very good because everyone hates Jonah, and so he got in a lot of trouble in the first episode, and it was fun to watch the entire White House staff just, like,
mercilessly mocking him.
Yeah.
And I think this was, I don't know if it was just something they came up with. A lot of times the showrunners have said that they didn't actually anticipate things that were going to happen. Like, they had already written the script, mm-hmm. and then stuff that was basically in their script happened in real life.
Right.
So it's, you know, life imitating art rather than the other way around. I think there was somebody got fired recently from the White House, or not probably the White House, but one of the, like, executive agencies or something, for having some sort of, you know, gossipy blog type mm-hmm. thing anonymously that was eventually uncovered. Or maybe it was a Twitter account or something. So this is not entirely unheard of for somebody to be trying to do that in this day and age, but clearly he's not very good despite his bravado. And, you know, I happen to think most of this political gossiptainment stuff is kind of a drag and, you know, not very interesting, but obviously it's what appeals to certain people. Later, when that causes problems for him, he starts a different blog, Ryantology, Jonah Ryan, right? And he's just basically screaming things into various cameras from his home in the middle of the night.
This is Jonah Ryan, and you are witnessing the birth of Ryantology.
Old media like the Washington Post better go run and hide in the bathroom and join the Poo York Times, because we are cutting in. I am going to be updating more than I'm actually dating, which is a load. First up, abortion. And now that the president's given his state of the uterus address, where will the others fall in? We have Maddox, he's conservative. Chung, he's liberal. But where does Selena Meyer stand? The first call could rule them all.
Sir, how do I turn this off?
You just hit the red button.
Funny, right?
Yeah, so this is, you know, I think a pretty good satire of that particular aspect, but I think you would probably agree this show in general is a very strong satire of kind of the Beltway culture or whatever, mm-hmm. right? We're moving away from that sort of Aaron Sorkin, you know, everything is wonderful and all our jobs are so important and we're making a difference and sometimes we got to compromise because that puts us in a position to do a better thing later. In this, it's all about compromising for literally no reason or just minuscule gains that will be erased by the next big thing, right? This is definitely a scandal-driven show in the way that Scandal is, of course, but this is a lot less melodramatic.
Everyone on her staff, including herself, is a terrible person.
Yeah, they're basically all monsters, but very, very funny monsters, and it's a lot of fun to watch. Obviously, as Dan said, there's a lot of cursing, and you could hear that by the fact that I had to remove them all to air this. Did you have any other thoughts on the show Veep in general, or why people should watch it, start watching now if they haven't already gotten on board with that?
People should watch it because I think the acting is top-notch, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I mean, I never watched a lot of Seinfeld or the other shows that she was on, but she's doing some really good work in this show, as can be attested by the fact that she's won 2 Emmys 2 years in a row for this role. I see no reason why, if this season keeps progressing the way it's going, why she won't win again. And that, and it's just, it's so funny. I watch a lot of shows per week, and this one, none of them makes me laugh as hard as this one does.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy to talk about Veep. We are both giving it high recommendations.
2 thumbs up.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that trademarked? Anyway, but yeah, go check out Veep as long as you don't mind a lot of cursing. But I think it's tasteful cursing in the sense that it's very creative
with
and
the plays
around with the English language. So, folks, if you want to follow more of Dan Fidler's commentary, go to Daniel_Fidler on Twitter. Follow him there. You can hear about various non-political pop culture things. And Dan, we'll get you back on the show to talk about Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier in our next segment.
Looking forward to it.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for April 21st, 2014. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.